Welcome to Season 2 of The Straight and Marrow, a podcast that discusses all things allogeneic bone marrow transplant, from pre-transplant considerations to survivorship, using experiences of healthcare professionals, patients and carers, with current evidence to keep it straight. The Straight and Marrow is sponsored by ARROW, the Bone Marrow Transplant Foundation. ARROW's mission is to improve the survival and quality of life for bone marrow transplant patients and to provide support for carers.
Thank you for joining us today, Dave. Welcome back. You're our first return guest to the podcast.
Welcome, Dave.
A truly auspicious occasion for me to come back.
Today we're hoping you can help us unbunk some tricky concepts of bone marrow transplant.
Sure. Easy peasy.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously these are things that they often roll off the tongue for us. We feel comfortable talking about them, but for our audience, they are concepts that don't roll off the tongue and require a little more explanation. So a really good one to start with, Dave, is what is HLA matching?
That's a good place to start. As many of our listeners and their families will know, that often early on in a conversation, when there's a diagnosis made that might ultimately require a bone marrow transplant, people, doctors and nurses, start talking about finding a match or finding someone who's matched to you. And what they're talking about when they use that jargon is finding somebody who has the same genetic makeup that's sufficiently shared by the immune system of the patient and the donor so that ultimately, when the transplant is done, the immune system behaves itself. So let me explain that a bit more. Of course, we talk about bone marrow transplantation, and we do that. We transplant the cells that are capable of growing the bone marrow. Some of our patients will have received truly bone marrow donated from the donor, which is marrow taken from the bones itself, or the stem cells that are in the bloodstream that are capable of growing a new bone marrow. And those stem cells, they're the same. They're the same whether they're taken directly out of the bone marrow or harvested, derived from bloodstream. When they get infused on that magical day zero, those stem cells have the capacity to build a whole new bone marrow. And that is bone marrow transplantation. But bone marrow transplantation is a package deal. It's a new bone marrow, and that's super important. But equally important is a new immune system. You get that new immune system from your donor in the same package that the stem cells come along with. So on day zero, the best way to think about a transplant is that it's a double organ transplant. One organ being the bone marrow, the second organ being the immune system, and they come along as a package deal. So the idea of matching is about matching the things that make the immune system tick. Matching the things that tell the immune system what it should react to and what it should leave alone. So, of course, our immune systems were never developed to put up with a bone marrow transplant. They were developed from an evolutionary perspective to help defend us against invaders, usually those invaders being viruses, like we've had experience with very recently, bacteria, fungi, and to some extent, things like worms and parasites. Our immune system has evolved over many millions of years to change, to put up with the challenges that nature throws at us. And the way it does that, the way that immune system fights those things, is by recognizing in our bodies what should be present. That's all the bits that make us tick. What should be present, our heart, our lungs, our guts. The immune system recognizes those things and says, those belong here, I'm going to leave them alone. But being also able to identify what shouldn't be there, what is a foreign substance, what's a foreign invader, bacteria or virus, some other form of microorganism, and recognize that invader as foreign and get rid of it. So that whole idea, that's a really important concept within immunology or the study of the immune system. And that's a phenomenon called self versus non-self. Self is everything that should be there, and the immune system says, I recognize you as a good piece of this person, I'm going to leave you alone, versus non-self, you don't belong here, I'm going to get rid of you. Now, all that's all very well and good if the only thing that's entering your body is a virus or a fungus or a bacteria. But if some clever bunch of doctors and nurses say to you, I'm actually going to give you a whole new bone marrow, the thing that determines or helps the immune system know that it should belong there are these things called HLA, human leukocyte antigens. So humans, well, that's pretty obvious what they are. Leukocytes are white blood cells, and antigens are anything on the outside of a cell that the immune system can recognize as foreign or not foreign, as the case may be. Now, those HLA molecules, they're on the outside of every single cell in the body, every single cell, except, as it turns out ironically, except for red blood cells. And if you can imagine two cells walking down a dark alley in opposite directions late at night, maybe it's raining, maybe the lighting's not so good, and they bump into each other, they've got to try and quickly determine, is this something that I'm going to attack, bring out my white blood cell knife and stab it? Or is this something I'm going to say, hey, friend, you belong here, I'm not going to kill you off? And it's those surface membranes bumping into each other, they've got literally a few minutes to figure out what they're going to do. And they do that by recognizing the HLA molecules. If the HLA molecules look foreign, the cell has a good feel around and says, I don't like the look of that, that doesn't feel right, there's three arms instead of two, it's probably something I'm going to get rid of. Now, HLA molecules are all encoded on one chromosome, chromosome 6. And like every chromosome, you get half from mum, you get half from dad, and every cell in the body will have two copies of chromosome 6. On each of those chromosome 6, there are HLA molecule genes, and those genes, like every gene in the body, codes for a protein. And those proteins are expressed on the outside of cells. And so if you get a code from mum that says you've got this particular combination of HLA genes, and you get a code from dad and he gives you the other half of those HLA genes, that's your typing. That's your tissue typing. That's the thing that we need to match against. Now, some people who've been following this along or reading up about it will know that there are varying degrees of matches. Some people will have heard of 8 out of 8 matches, 10 out of 10 matches. And that's just transplant doctors and transplant scientists being too clever. They're really talking about the same thing. There are 4 super important HLA genes. They're called A, B, C, and you guessed it, D. Right. You've got 2 sets of those. One set, A, B, C, D, on one chromosome 6, and another set of A, B, C, D on your other chromosome 6. One set came from mum, one set came from dad. And those are the things that need to match. Now, there are a couple of other sort of minor sets. There's a DP and a DQ. Now, if you add up A, B, C, D, D, P, and D, Q, that's 6. And there's 2 copies of each, that's 12. So depending on how far you go will determine whether you are finding an 8 out of 8, a 10 out of 10, or a 12 out of 12. Really, once you go beyond A, B, C, D, the rest becomes pretty small print. So that's why most centres will say 8 out of 8 matching. Now, because those genes are given to you by mum and dad, the people who are most likely in the entire world to share the same set of genes as you are your brothers and sisters. So when it's safe to do so, when brothers and sisters are well enough, when they're sufficiently informed, and remember our donor coordinators will spend a lot of time answering questions that are posed to them by our donors. What does it involve? What does it mean to be a donor? How can I help? A lot of counselling goes in behind the scenes. But when it's safe to do so, we'll ask family members to provide us some of their DNA. Because like everything else in the body, the genes are coded by DNA. Now, in the olden days, we used to do DNA sampling by blood tests, but we now can get adequate DNA from just doing a cheek swab, the same sort of swab the police might do if they're trying to rule you out in some horrible, grisly crime. But from that DNA sample, we can actually determine what HLA genes you've got, and by literally lining them up on a piece of paper with the DNA sample from the patient, we can see whether they're matched or not. Some of you will have heard about half-matched donations, and that's where instead of being 8 out of 8 matched, the person only shares half of the genetic makeup of those HLA genes, and just a fancy word for half is haplo. So about a 1 in 4 chance of a brother or sister matching you. What happens if you don't have someone in your family who matches you? Now, one of the things, just quickly as an aside, as we talk about half-matched transplants, is that every child of a patient will be half-matched. And every parent of a patient will be half-matched. And so increasingly what we're seeing is that people who don't have matched brothers or sisters, they may have a half-matched brother or sister, or if they're young enough and their parents are young enough and well enough, may have a half-matched parent, or if their kids are old enough and understand what's going on, they may have a half-matched child who can donate to that patient. So haploidentical transplantation has really broadened up the opportunity to go ahead with transplantation under some circumstances and for some people. But one of the things that we're super, super lucky to have as an international community of transplanters is volunteer donors who sign up to registries. Now, they don't have it all done instantaneously because most people who sign up to the registry will never be called on to donate. And every time you do an HLA gene analysis, it costs quite a lot of money. Nonetheless, those excellent volunteers sign up to the registry and have some of their genetic material analyzed. And they say, well, look, let's just do A and B typing for now and put that in the computer. Now, the best analogy that I can give you on this excellent podcast is actually online dating. Not that I actually practice it myself, but I've heard it can be quite successful. So online dating is a bit like registry. There's a whole bunch of people who are signed up. They say, I am willing to try and be a partner to somebody. Here's some information about me. I'm 5'10", I have dark hair, I have green eyes, I like pina coladas and walking in the dunes and so on and so forth. Here's some information, right?
We've learned so much more about you.
Yeah, I know. So none of that describes me. I don't like pina coladas. Anyway, so there's some information stored on a website, and that's the same as the volunteer donors. There's some information stored on them. So you put in your likes in your online dating app and says, I'm only interested in people who are over 5'8", who have green or blue eyes, who are not blonde, but do like alcoholic tropical beverages, and you get some matches. You get some potential matches. Maybe 10 people fit that profile. They may not be the perfect person for you, but they're in the right ballpark. So you then get an opportunity to ask them some more questions. When you say tropical alcoholic beverages, do you mean pina coladas? And they might say, no, it's actually daiquiris. And you say, okay, well, you're not for me, right? You're not for me. But they say, yeah, I'm a pina colada person. And you get to ask them more questions. And then you say, you know, eventually as the conversation warms up, I said, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Are you an apartment or a house person? Do you want to have kids? You know, and so you try and find the perfect partner for you. And that's the same, it's exactly the same as finding a donor. some information is available, some HLA typing is done, they might be a match for you. And so your friendly donor coordinator will then ask those additional questions for you. Hey, do you reckon are you still on the registry? Do you still want to donate? And how about we have a closer look at your DNA, at your HLA, and make sure you're actually the perfect match?
Yeah. Can anyone sign up to be a bone marrow donor?
So brothers and sisters, as long as they're physically well, can donate at any age. If, for example, some of our younger patients might have brothers and sisters who are still in their early teens or even younger, if the potential donor is under the age of 18 within the family, you can't sign up to an unrelated donor registry unless you're an adult. But within the family, if you're under the age of 18, certainly our practice here in Melbourne is to ask our children's health colleagues to help us out with the appropriate assessments, with the appropriate advice, with the appropriate counselling in the presence of mum and dad or other carers. And often the children's hospital will actually do the process of collecting the cells for us from younger donors, I should say. But generally speaking, the thing that determines the suitability of donation is, of course, being matched, which is what we've just been talking about, being physically and psychologically well. There are some instances where it's just not safe to use the cells, and they're pretty rare, but we want to screen for those ahead of time, and the donor coordinators, one of their super important jobs is to make sure that any product that we're going to use in the form of transplantation, whether it be bone marrow or blood stem cells, that it's safe for the donor to donate and that it's safe for the recipient to receive. And that's fundamentally what we're all about, is making transplants as safe as they possibly can be. And a really, really important element of making things safe is to make sure people are matched, which is why we're talking about this important topic. Alex, what I think you might be referring to is what about signing up to a registry?
Yeah.
You know, being a volunteer donor to someone that you certainly don't know and will probably never meet, a true volunteer, a true altruistic gift. So you have to be an adult, you have to be over 18, but there is an upper age limit as well, because as I've said, most people who sign up to registries will never be called on to donate, just statistical likelihood. But we want to make sure that if people do sign up to registries, that they still remain able to donate should they be asked to. So registries, most international registries around the world really won't sign up people who are over the age of 50.
Is there a way that you can demystify the concept of chimerism? Hmm. Talk a little bit about its interpretation, so how you interpret it, and what does it mean in the context of allogeneic bone marrow transplants?
So the best way to demystify chimerism is to actually tell you a mythical story. So those of you who are classic scholars out there will know that a chimera is a mythical beast. It's a mythical creature. Most classic scholars would agree that the chimera as described in Greek mythology is a mixture of a lion, a goat and a serpent, three things. And that's sort of where the term chimerism comes from. Is that after a transplant, the blood system, the bone marrow and all the blood cells that come from the bone marrow and circulate in the blood, they are from somebody else. And they live in another person, another being, and that is the recipient. And so we have a mixture of two things. Measuring how things are growing is really a super important way of determining overall health. And that's true of post-bone marrow transplantation. So chimerism is a measurement of how much of the bone marrow or how much of the blood cells have come from the donor. How well is those newly planted seeds, which is what stem cells are and what the immune system are, how well are they growing into a fully flourishing new bone marrow and your immune system. So this weird Greek word chimerism really just is a fancy medical way of sort of basically saying how much of the blood or bone marrow is now growing from the donor, and how much is left over from the original bone marrow or immune system. So we can take a blood test at day 30, and hardworking members of our bone marrow transplant laboratory team will take those white blood cells, take those blood cells out of the blood, and we can actually separate them out into two subfamilies of white blood cells. The cells that make the neutrophils and the cells that make the immune system. The cells that make the neutrophils, we give the term myeloid. Myelo is a reference to the bone marrow. The immune system, that doesn't grow in the bone marrow. That grows in the lymph glands and various other organs, the spleen and the thymus. And so they're often called not myeloid, but lymphoid. So the immune system is part of the lymphoid system, and the neutrophils, and as it turns out, the red blood cells and the platelets are part of the myeloid cells growing in the bone marrow. But those cells, when they're in the bone marrow or in the lymph glands, they travel around and do their job in the blood. And if you take a blood sample and you get some white blood cells out of the blood sample, there'll be neutrophil-type cells and lymphocyte-type cells, and you can separate those out in the laboratory and analyze them separately. And you can ask a question: where do these cells come from? Were they grown by the bone marrow or the lymph glands of my patient, or were they grown from the cells that we transplanted on day zero? And what we do before transplant day, we'll take a small DNA fingerprint from the recipient, from the blood of the recipient, from the blood of the patient. And we'll analyze that for just some DNA fingerprint, sort of a code that's unique to that individual. So a chimerism result, when it's talked to you, when you come along to the clinic, the guys might say, you're 100% donor. Every single cell we analyze in the blood has been derived from the donor. Or they might say, you're 70% donor. 70% of the cells in the blood are derived from the donor. The other 30% are derived from your original cells. So we start to use terms like complete chimerism. It's completely the donor. Or mixed chimerism. There's still a mixture from donor and recipient. So that's useful information. It's usually the vast, vast majority of individuals, it's reassuring information, because they said what we set out to do is get a new bone marrow, a new immune system, and by analyzing that with a DNA fingerprint, we can tell that that new bone marrow and that new immune system have come from the donor. 100% donor chimerism. And there are a few things that we do in order to tip the balance in favor of the donor cells, to increase that contribution from the donor so it's getting closer and closer to 100%. One of the first things that we'll do, when it's safe to do so, is to take away the old horrible poison cyclosporin. So for those of you who are listening to us after your transplant, you'll know how much what I'm talking about there. What that does is it sort of takes the handbrake off the donor immune system. It gives it encouragement to grow more and take over. So often we will just simply, by taking away the cyclosporin a bit earlier than we would normally do, that's often enough to let those donor cells take over. Now, we don't want to do that in a rush, because that those immune system cells, even if they're only representing 70% of the immune system cells, they're still capable of lots of powerful things. Lots of powerful things that we want them to do, like make sure leukemia stays away. Lots of powerful things that we want them to do, like make sure CMV stays away, virus, a viral infection, and other viruses and other infections. That's the immune system's job. But we don't want it to get too carried away and cause graft versus host disease. So the first thing to do when we see mixed chimeras is do not panic. Now, we do know that if we allow people to sit there with mixed chimerism and don't push things in favor of the donor takeover, then we won't get all of the benefit out of transplantation that we would have hoped to. If the immune system from the donor is not dominating and is not strong, then some of the benefit of the bone marrow transplant won't be realised. And that's just a really fancy way of saying you increase the risk that the leukemia might come back. So the reason we measure it is mainly reassurance. You're doing exactly as we expect you to do.
Yes. What happens if the chimerism is not working? Is the bone marrow not working? Is the chimerism dropping? What do we do next?
So one of the things that's really true about bone marrow transplantation is that it's a competition. It's a competition between the cells that came along originally that our patient has and the new one that we want to give. Now, we tilt the balance really strongly in favour of the new cells from the donor by giving chemotherapy, giving radiation therapy, using medications that suppress the recipient, the patient's immune system, that really tries to provide a completely uneven playing field in favour of the donor cells being able to take over. And that's what happens the vast majority of the time. We want to make sure that situation is happening, and so we measure the chimerism, and that gives us further information. So, Alex, your question is about what if we see mixed chimerism and we know we're a bit worried that that might not provide all the strength of the transplant that we were hoping for, and therefore there might be a risk that leukemia or the myelodysplasia or the lymphoma or whatever the reason the transplant was done, that that may not be eradicated as much as we would like it to be. So what do we do? So we tip the balance even further in favour of the donor's immune system by giving extra immune system cells from the donor, essentially immune system cell top-ups. Those are from the donor. Those immune system cells, remember what we talked about, they are lymphocytes and they're given by infusion. They're given by drip, sometimes through a Hickman line, sometimes through a peripheral blood cannula, whatever, they just as long as they go into the vein by infusion. And our jargon around the traps with all the cool transplant kits in the hood.
We like acronyms.
Yeah, we like acronyms. Is DLI, but it just describes what it is. Cells from the donor, immune system cells from the donor given as an infusion. Those DLI cells are usually cells that we have stored from the original donation by the donor. So remembering that most people that are donating are well, if they're unrelated donors, they're usually young, they're usually well-fed and usually bigger than our recipients, and they usually donate many, many, many more cells than we need to safely do the initial transplant. So we don't throw those cells away. If there's extra cells, we'll give as many as we need to do a safe first transplant. If there are extra cells and above and beyond that amount, we will store those cells in our laboratory, in our clinical laboratory, and those cells remain earmarked for that patient. We can't use them for anybody else. They belong to that patient. Go through the transplant, we measure the chimerism, and we find out that it's mixed, and we say, we'd prefer it to be really 100% donor. What can we do? Well, we take away the cyclosporin, we monitor a bit more, we see that it's perhaps not coming up as quickly as we would like, or in some instances actually going further down. And we'll say, okay, let's top up the immune system with extra cells from the donor. Now, for those people who haven't had a transplant or haven't experienced DLI, you might think, geez, going through a whole nother transplant? That seems like a pretty extraordinary thing. But it's actually much simpler than that. We don't give more chemo, we don't give more radiation therapy, and we don't use DLI when people are still taking cyclosporin, and we don't restart the cyclosporin for DLI. So the DLI, the donor lymphocyte infusions, are given like a little tiny mini transplant, that little bag of cells infused over the course of a few minutes into a vein. And we do that with starting with a small dose. It's done as an outpatient. Person comes in for an hour or so, has it done, goes home if they're well enough to go home. And we monitor. We repeat the chimerism. We make sure that those donor cells haven't topped up so much that they might be starting to cause some graft versus host disease. So before we give the second dose, we are measuring the chimerism, how much of things being boosted, and the clinical activity of those cells. Is there any sign, and remember that your transplant nurses and doctors are very well trained at identifying graft versus host disease, is there any sign to suggest that there's any graft versus host disease? If the answer is, we've still got more work to do, we've got more boosting to do, and they haven't caused any downside, let's give another dose. And we can do that 3 or 4 times in a row and measure each time. Now, I'm thinking about a patient of mine, had a very straightforward transplant, had a particular diagnosis called myelofibrosis, had a pretty straightforward transplant, got out to about day 60 or so, and his chimerism was falling. We took his blood samples, we separated in the lab, did a DNA fingerprint comparison, and his donor cells were only representing about 10% of his immune system. Now, if we hadn't intervened at that point, his donor cells would have eventually been outcompeted and pushed out. And with time, probably his myelofibrosis would come back. So we said, okay, you've had no graft versus host disease, you're otherwise well, you've got safe blood counts, let's top up that immune system by giving DLI. That was entirely done as an outpatient. We monitored for graft versus host disease, there wasn't any. He got the DLI, and he turned that donor measurement chimerism from 10% over the course of a few months to 100%. Now, that's part of the process of having a transplant. We don't need everything to happen on day zero. What we're putting in place in day zero is a playing field where all of the pieces of the transplant are in action, and we measure the pieces of the transplant. The first thing we measure is the neutrophils growing back. The next thing we measure is the platelets growing back. This is part of the process. The next thing we measure is the immune system growing back. And if it needs a boost along the way, well, we give that to them.
I really like the analogy of it being kind of like a competition between the cells. That's great.
Yeah. Mm. Well, Dave, thank you for your time. Thank you for breaking down some really tricky concepts, HLA typing, chimerism, and donor lymphocyte infusions, or DLI, as we like to call them. Thanks for coming back a second time.
My pleasure. Keep tuning in. I might come back a third time.
Yes.
Yep, you'll definitely be invited back.
Thanks for listening, and hope you've enjoyed the podcast as much as we have. Just a reminder that although our Straight and Marrow team are experienced healthcare professionals, we are unable to give individual medical advice. If you have a medical query, please speak to your treating team. See you next time at the Straight and Marrow, and don't forget to subscribe to receive podcast updates. And for more information about ARROW, the Bone Marrow Transplant Foundation, go to arrow.org.au.